The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchen.
And me, Lachlan Bloom.
If you're listening for the first time, this is a podcast where we interview other writers of literary fiction about their craft, technique and approach.
And in this episode, episode 33, we spoke to Gabriel Giuseppevici. We spoke remotely in August this year and had a really great chat about his long back catalogue of work and his approach to writing.
Yeah, I mean, he's been sort of writing since the end of the 60s. I think his first novel was published at the end of the 60s. And I think he's sort of really been carving out a very interesting route. I think he's an interesting writer in that a lot of the other writers we've spoken to, maybe not during the interviews, but while chatting with them, have mentioned him as a writer that they find interesting. So I think it was really good for us to be able to catch up with him as, you know, hear about his work.
And I think, yeah, it was reflected in his technique of writing and his approach, especially we kind of talked about some of his major works as well as what he's been doing during lockdown to pass the time.
Yeah, that's interesting. He set himself a specific challenge and it was interesting to hear him talk about that, yeah. Now, the recording of our actual interview did sneak out. It was previously scheduled to come out in sort of the middle of September, and due to a bit of oversight, it came out before we had done the tidying up bit. So if you heard it, hopefully you'll listen again.
Just erase that from your memory and listen afresh. Just now.
Anyway, thank you for listening to this version, and here he is, Gabriel Giuseppevici. So we often ask about kind of craft and the real business end of it. So I might start with that just because in the interview I read with you, you were speaking about your first novel that you wrote by spending a few hours in the morning, you described it as. Do you still have a similar sort of writing pattern that you work to?
Yes. I mean, I find that unless it's absolutely kind of going swimmingly or getting towards the end, it's a morning's work, or even just a couple of hours is quite sufficient. And then one spends the rest of the day. I know when I was teaching, it was tricky because if I then had teaching to do in the afternoon, somehow part of my mind was already thinking, oh well, I must stop here, etc. If I try teaching in the morning and having the afternoon free, I was tired. So it's, having the whole day, but actually only doing, sitting down at the desk for a couple of hours every morning. Mm-hmm.
Is that first thing in the morning? So would you sort of before breakfast? Or?
No. I have breakfast and then sit down. I'd love to be able to, go for a walk if it's going to be fine in the morning and grey in the afternoon. But I found those are the best times. Just after breakfast, and which used to be 8 o'clock, and now it's near 9.
I think we've all had the timings have slipped with lockdown. Fine.
Not just lockdown, I'm afraid it's age as well. I tend to maybe wake up at the same time and read a bit in bed.
So your especially your earlier novels, which I've read about but haven't read themselves in depth. I'm far more familiar with your more recent stuff, but the importance of dialogue in your earlier novels and the spoken, the language that people use and things like that. How do you go about kind of planning that and putting that together? And is there a long period of research of trying to sort of settle on the voices and the people that will be involved? Or do you wait for a sort of germ to seed and then run with it?
Yeah, I mean, there's no such thing as research. And when I've occasionally written books that, look as if they might need it, I avoid going to libraries and things. But, occasionally I would. When I was writing Infinity, and behind it was this Italian composer, Giacinto Scelsi, I read you know, some of his writings. But no, otherwise, I don't really even think, you know, he's going to have that voice, she's going to have that voice, etc. Clearly, that has to be there from the start. There has to be a sense of some excitement in dealing with a situation and characters and so on. And then I really just let it go the way it wants and then, you know, come back, obviously.
Thinking about the start, is there a particular moment normally that you've kind of realized that I've started a new project today, I've started a new novel? Or, and how do you realize that? How do you know that is the start of something?
It's terrible. I mean, I know Thomas Bernhardt started with the last sentence. If he got the last sentence right, he was, you know, felt he could get going. No, usually there have been lots of false starts. I don't worry too much about it. If I started to worry and think, this is the start, I think I'd just freeze. So it's a matter of trying to just get into it. And again, if I can just take the Chelsea, the Infinity, as an example, 2011, I think it was, I knew early on that it had to be mediated through a rather uneducated voice, as it were. So that was it, and it had to be an interview in which this person would be answering questions without actually much interference by the interviewer, just putting down the questions. So that was there from very early on. But of course, I got going and then stalled and went back and stalled again and went back. And then, you know, at a certain point, it just takes off. One hopes. Often it doesn't.
Because I saw you sort of mentioned that when you first started writing, the idea of having a plot and knowing exactly where it was going to go and then having to flesh that out was just too burdensomely boring to start working on. And I think that probably would apply to quite a lot of the writers that we speak to on this podcast, I think. Does that mean that you've never really sort of planned sort of points or, you know, sort of arcs or anything like that, that it's just you're happy to go with the voice and see where that takes you?
No, I think usually there's a sort of overarching rhythm and a sense of how it must end, but again, how it must end rhythmically. You know, it's going to be up or it's going to be down or somehow. So I know I'm driving towards that. Usually, it's not always the case. But there's been this feeling, there has to be a sense of, so a kind of shape, but I couldn't draw it and I couldn't describe it, but I've got to feel it. That's part of what walking is good for. Got to feel it and feel what I always think to myself of as the limits, things I can't cross, boundaries I can't cross, which are holding me in. If there are no boundaries, then the thing just flounders. But if I can feel, yes, you know, it's not, it can't do this or it mustn't do that, then that's already something in place. Very negative, but it's there. And it's felt so that I tend
does
to
that
know
normally them. Come along at the same time as you have a sense of the shape of the character or the voice? The two kind of come joined together, that you have a certain period of trial and error, trying different voices and different starts. And then once you get the character and the shape of the voice, you also have instantly almost the idea of the boundaries and those limits of where that voice is going to go.
Yeah. I've often thought of, had wonderful ideas of you know, something that happened, something in life or something that I want to depict. And I've often had what I think of as great ideas for a certain form, but both by themselves just don't work. Somehow there has to be the sense of a something out there, some kind of existential issue, and the form that is going to make it work. So if there's one without the other, as I say, it's flat. And I've sometimes gone for months because I've been excited by the form, or I've been, and you know, the form might be okay, maybe for a short story I can get by. But if it's going to be a novel, there has to be an input into something that I can believe in and live.
And so when you talk about the sort of boundaries or limits of the story, you're talking about the sort of conceptual framework, the form of literally.
No, it's difficult to say. It's sometimes even the language that is going to be used, or the.
But it's not limits on the character per se. It's not sort of, oh, this character is going to only spend their time in one country and they're not going to travel. Or, you know, it's not plot limits. It's
no.
Conceptual limits more.
No. It's something conceptual, and again, it has to do with rhythm and so on. It's maybe deeper than that. I mean, with that novel I wrote about that American artist, Joseph Cornell.
Yeah, Hotel Andromeda.
There, I knew that he couldn't look into himself, because that was against the what I felt to be his character. So that was one of the problems. I'd originally thought of somehow writing it directly about him, but I couldn't get there because I felt by doing that I'd be actually destroying what interested me. Him. Although he has plenty of diaries, somehow the diaries are really not reflective at all. And so that was a big problem. And then in the end, I had to sort of accept that it would have to be done completely indirectly by having somebody write about
it. Yes, I guess in that case, it kind of crosses the boundary. The limit is a mix of aspects of the character and more formalistic aspects of writing.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
And you seem to have sort of brought in the work of composers and artists into your work. Does this sort of creative process in other media sort of inform how you view writing literature and your approach to writing?
You mean the books that I like?
Or also the way that composition happens in other art forms? Has that had a sort of crossover into how you view writing?
I mean, not all my novels are that, but certainly early on there were one or two stories. I'd written a very early story about the Vermeer woman at the clavichord in the National Gallery, and another one about a painter, but it was fairly, you know, I'd written quite a few novels before I wrote Contre-Jour, the book with Bonnard, a sort of Bonnard figure at the back. But that did seem to release things. And I thought after that, no, I don't want ever to write a book about an artist again or have an artist in the center, because, you know, that would sort of terribly fix me and typecast me as well as being something. And of course, then the very next book, I found myself writing about Duchamp in The Big Glass. So that was kind of pushing to be written. I'm not altogether happy with that. I'd love to move on, but that does seem to deliver for me and free up spaces.
And then it, is that that in your critical work you sort of have to take a broader assessment of art and culture as a whole, or is that that your interest in reading takes you to the work of painters and composers? Or,
well, not just in reading, but I found from very early on that most of my best friends, or certainly my best friends within the arts, didn't tend to be other writers, but tended to be composers to begin with, and then painters. I just found, perhaps because of my kind of continental way of working, as you know, people sort of tend to put it, interest. I mean, I think right from the start, when I was trying to write as an adolescent and feeling, oh dear, you know, English is, in a way, is not my language. It's a language I came to when I was five. England's not my country. I'm not inward. I'd love to be inward and be able to, you know, write like a Muriel Spark or something, have at my fingertips a variety of idiolects and so on. But that's just not going to happen. That's you've got to play with the cards you're dealt with. And so I think I felt that painters and composers were international, didn't depend on a particular language. And when I talked to composers, mainly the composer Gordon Cross, who became a close friend when we were students at Oxford, and then Jonathan Harvey later on, and painters like Timothy Hyman and Andrei Jakovsky, that they had the same sorts of interests, really, as I did. International, cutting across boundaries, but of course, mainly figurative painters or a certain kind of figurative painter, and I suppose a certain kind of composer.
In any conversation about your process as compared with painting or composing, do you feel there's similarities or differences in terms of, I guess, the sort of gestation period of a piece? I mean, I guess there's parallels between writing short fiction and doing sketches for a painter, or novels and larger pieces. How do you, I mean, I guess I'm interested in how the sort of period from beginning to end, how long that is typically, if there is a typically, and how you see that playing compared with other art forms or other means of creating.
I'll start with the earlier thing about whether there is anything in common. That, I think, is it. I felt immediately that when I was talking to painters or composers about their projects, what they were involved with, how they worked, what they were interested in, it touched a chord in me. This was the kind of thing I was interested in. Whereas talking to novelists, it usually wasn't the case. And so I suppose that became the basis for friendship. Of course, it's very different. I remember a composer I knew who'd been to some BAMF for somewhere, some big American, you know, retreat for artists, saying that, you know, he was a composer and the composers tended to start at 8 a.m. and not finish till 8 p.m. The painters started at 5 a.m. and finished at 1, and then spent the afternoon drinking. And the writers, you know, tended to work for 3 or 4 hours and then go and play tennis or game or whatever. So I think there are differences, inevitably. You know, you have to put a lot of notes down if you're to write a, you know, 10-minute piece of music, whereas you write a 10-minute play and there aren't all that many words. And again, painting is a much more simultaneous and immediate activity, and painters can have lots of things on the go at the same time. So, of course, there are huge differences. I think they're more superficial. I think at certainly I felt that at heart, there were things that we had in common that I felt were illuminating for me in sort of talking to them, and that they were prepared and open about the art of the past that they were interested in and learned from and that enriched them. Whereas on the whole, you know, one can get very literate writers, but they don't seem to have that sense that this is going to stimulate them all that much going back.
Do you think it would have been possible to write the way you've written and what you've written without that sort of cross talk with...
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I know that when I, in my first term at Oxford, I went round to the rooms of Gordon Cross. I'd only recently met him, and we talked, and he said he was composer, and he showed me this score that was one sheet on his wall. And he said, this is by a young German avant-garde composer called Karlheinz Stockhausen. It's a piano piece. You can start at any point and move around, and it's all there on this sheet. And I suddenly thought, yeah, I've come to the right place. I just felt, yes, this is exciting.
So with the, as a critic, I guess, with me, I sort of first came across your work with your book about Whatever Happened to Modernism. And is that still a kind of, what's the word? I don't really want to call it a tradition, but a creative movement that you feel your work is very engaged in still?
I mean, that was, in a way, a horrible book to write and horrible aftermath in all its stuff that went with publishing it. I'd much rather write only about, you know, not write polemically, write about books and authors and art I love. And I'd done that for many, many years. And it was just a feeling. I gave a lecture. I was asked to give a lecture, and I thought, well, you know, for a long time, I just haven't said anything about why I don't like the art I don't like. And nobody, you know, the only people who pay attention to the things I write about the books I love are people who already, as it were, are won over and so on. So maybe I should address that. And there were so many questions at the end of that lecture, which was at London, actually, at the Institute Advanced Study. And so many, I thought, ridiculous questions as well as very illuminating ones. I was sort of felt impelled to go on and flesh it out. Mm-hmm. But I'm not all that happy with writing polemically in that way. I really would much rather tease out and illuminate things that I like, because that's what, you know, what gives me real pleasure.
Do you mean that as a critic or as a fiction writer?
I don't divide them. I mean, it gives me pleasures as a critic, but it gives me pleasure as a person to as, you know, if you love a film, you try and press your friends to go and see it. Well, I think criticism is not all that different. It could be a bit more sophisticated than that. But basically, it's saying, yeah, good, go on, read it, or see it, or whatever. That, to me, is the kind of, you know, criticism I like to read. So, obviously, it's the kind I like to write.
But do you consider yourself as a modernist writer, whatever that might mean?
Well, again, I mean, I was unhappy at having to sort of use those terms, because clearly they're so loaded and so on, but, you know, one needs shortcuts, and there is such a thing. I think that there are obviously connections between the arts and across the arts, and I suppose that was the exciting thing about talking to composers and painters. I've always felt that it's artificial to talk about, you know, literature separate from the arts, or English literature separate from other literatures, or modern literature separate from earlier literature. So somehow, you know, that's been the you know, it's clear that, you know, Wordsworth, Friedrich and Beethoven have something in common. And I was lucky at Sussex in that, you know, the place was sort of set up in a way to explore that and allow people, students and faculty and so on, to explore that. And I suddenly felt, yes, another place I was happy to come to. And with, you know, the modern world, too often I think people then say, ah, yes, you know, industrialization or the First World War or the Eiffel Tower or supermarkets. And, you know, there are quite interesting relations between that and certain movements in the arts, but I feel it goes much deeper than that. And I suppose it was an attempt to tease that out. I simply find pragmatically that the writers I turn to tend to be those that I do describe as kind of modernist and think of as modernist. But then it could be somebody accused me after that book, I mean, a sympathetic reader, of talking about all the books I liked and saying they're all modernist, and then you know, I didn't like them. So that's a danger. But not only that, because I love medieval literature, and to me it's wonderfully, and Shakespeare indeed, and I mean earlier literature, pre-Romantic literature, for almost the opposite reason, that it gives me a sense of a kind of innocence or freedom or whatever, which I don't think is possible anymore.
I think, yeah, with the idea of the sort of boundaries or limits to writing, I think it reading sort of medieval literature or pre-modernist literature, you have a sense that the boundaries were a lot more inviolable than they are now, which creates a certain freedom in that you don't have the options, whereas now you can do anything. And obviously you could have done anything at any point, but there is a sense.
Can I just interrupt you? I've got a little thing that's come up on saying the meeting has been upgraded by the host, now includes unlimited minutes, and I have to tick whether it's okay.
Yeah, if that's right. So a box came up and it was in the middle of my screen, so I just sort of clicked on it. I didn't really read what it said. But I think it means it's not going to cut us off at 40 minutes, maybe.
Yeah.
I stopped listening to these things.
I was just agreeing in terms of the older literature, medieval literature, and so on. There's a sense that those limits or boundaries are implicit in the writing, just purely from the way literature and society was shaped at the time. That it creates, you would imagine, a freedom for the writer, in that they don't have to worry about a lot of things that modern day writers have to worry about.
Yeah, absolutely. But also, I think in medieval literature, I got a sense when I was studying it at Oxford and reading it that somehow, you know, all those things that are taboo in a way in discussing these things, like a more integrated society, and, you know, that the religion and the art were much more one, et cetera, et cetera. Was absolutely true. And, you know, to discover that Eliot or Proust were saying, you know, had themselves described how they fell in love with a Dante, with a medieval cathedral, made me feel, yes, you know, there is a sense that these, you know, you can be modern or modernist or whatever. And in fact, it can be part of what you are as such, that you have a love for this very different and very early, much earlier culture. And that, of course, as always with earlier things, gives one the confidence to follow one's instinct.
And thinking about fiction as not distinct from other art forms, but is there a place or something that literature can touch that is sort of unique in some way, that you felt you were able to achieve something that went beyond what your compatriots doing, painting or composing, were able to do? There was a place that literature could get to that other art forms struggled to get to, or there was more direct routes to get to that place, if that makes sense.
Well, usually, I've seen, it does make sense. Usually, I've seen it the other way around. Ah, envying them because, you know, they were didn't need language, because they could go directly somehow. But of course, I can see that the fact that literature exists in time, I've always been very interested in forms and narratives, really because of that, because of trying to convey this sense that we exist in time. That's not something that painting obviously does very easily. I think some painters, interestingly, like Bonnard, manage it, but it goes against the grain. It's there with composers. But then, as Auden said, I think somewhere, you know, you can listen to a piece of music and actually be daydreaming, but you can't really read a book and be daydreaming because, you know, after a few pages, you think, what the hell's been going on? So there's a sense in which the words are gripping you and you're either there or you're not there in a way that doesn't really hold for viewers or listeners of art or music. So there are all these positives, but actually in writing, I usually find it's the negatives.
Yeah.
Oh, if only.
Yeah,
only.
I think as a writer, you're always aware of how easy it is in other art forms. Isn't it?
That's right. Of course, isn't, but you know, you think.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Unsound Methods. We hope you're enjoying the show. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter at Unsound Methods or view our website at unsoundmethods.co.uk.
In terms of that sort of temporal quality, thinking music, obviously there is a very temporal aspect to music, and a piece of music you would listen to over and over if you really liked it. You almost can't get it out of your head, and you listen to it day after day. In terms of literature, do you reread other people's work firstly, and also your own work? And how does that feed into the sort of editing process or the writing process for you?
I mean, I don't reread books to, you know, been published on the whole. They seem too dreadful to look at. If I open them, I think, oh my God. But no, I do. I suppose that's why I write very short books, because I'd like people to get to the end and start again at the beginning. And I have done that with a few novels I particularly like. If not sort of immediately, but certainly in the next, you know, week or so. And I felt that what was important, I think the novels I like are those where you feel that you do want to reread them. There are novels that I read in bed that I thoroughly enjoy, that really once you've read them, you don't really want to go back to. But the books that I really treasure are nearly always books that have that kind of rhythmic quality. You know, once you're in it, you just have to keep going within it. And at the end, it's sort of done something for you that you feel you'd like doing to you again, as with listening to the music one likes.
And you said about how a lot of your books are quite short novels. Is that a sort of, besides hoping that means that people want to reread it again at the end, that sort of economy, does that reflect an interest that you have in the sort of books you read as well? Do you have a preference for short novels, or do you think it's just that it's about refining it? It's the intellectual exercise of making it as efficient as you can.
No, I think there are a lot of answers to that. I think one answer is that, almost a physical one, that we all have our sort of kind of length, which may sometimes be exceeded. But, you know, I remember a composer saying, that, you know, you always wrote things that were 14 minutes long. And then there was one who thought, great, yeah, this is really going to be big. And so, and when he finally came to time, it was 14 and a half minutes long. And I mean, this has happened to me quite often with novels. And I thought, this is the big one. Not that, you know, I particularly want to write a big one, but, you know, it would be nice to get away from that under 200 pages sort of thing. And then it's ended up by rarely being that. Not for intellectual reasons, but obviously one doesn't want extraneous and flabby matter, but more important, I think, once you're working the way I'm working, where rhythm is an important component and where the whole thing has to have its own aura, its own, you can't really write the sort of Dostoevsky book, which, you know, is wonderful and which I love reading when I'm in the mood. And obviously I love some very long books like A la Recherche or Perec's Vie mode d'emploi. But by and large, you're right. I mean, I'd much rather read Melville's Bartleby than Moby Dick, and I'd much rather read, I don't know, Seize the Day of Saul Bellow than Humboldt's Gift.
So it's something I want to champion sometimes on this podcast, especially because we're trying to get people who are interested in writing who might not have gone through sort of English literature degrees or anything like that, or don't have access to creative writing courses. I feel that there's a really false sense in this country, and I think it comes from commercial fiction, that if you approach publishers or agents with a novel that is not at least 70,000 words, there's no point in trying to take it out anywhere. No one is going to publish it. And it really galls me. Because I think there are, you know, it does mean that there's a lot of novels that end up being 400 pages that would have worked fine at 200 pages. But
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, when I'm reading, flicking through, you know, book reviews and come to the fiction reviews, I tend to look at the page numbers. And if it's 446 pages, I skip the review because I know that by and large, I mean, there'd be exceptions, of course. When I first was in Paris and I'd loved some of Perec's early work, which I'd happened upon quite by chance, and I saw this huge, great, as it seemed, blockbuster called La Vie Mode d'Emploi. I kept thinking, oh, well, you know, every writer in their 40s thinks they've got to write some great monster. And after that, I began to think, well, it won't get into my suitcase and so on. Then I went into the bookshop and finally sort of opened it and thought, hey, this isn't your kind of American blockbuster type of long novel. It's doing something completely different. So, I was lucky, I suppose. Well, with The Inventory, the first novel, which was very short, the first people I sent it to liked it and said, yes, but it's a bit short. We'd like to do it with a few stories. And in the arrogance of youth, I said, no, it's got to resonate within its own sort of covers. So they said, well, thank you very much. And when it was turned down by the next 10 publishers, I began to think, what an idiot I was. And finally it was accepted. And I went to see my boss, David Deitches, and said, you know, I've had this novel finally accepted. And he said, and when I asked the publisher, I had lunch with him, and said, the editor there, and I said, don't you think it's terribly short? He said, no, we like short novels, it cuts down overheads. And Deitches said, they don't know really what they're looking for. They think it's something, but then if they like something, they find reasons for it.
Yes, I'm sure there's a parallel timeline where you're looking back now saying, oh, I wrote two or three stories on spec to add to that collection, and they really just didn't quite fit with what I was doing. I should have published it by itself. So,
Yeah.
Do you feel that it's something, once you've got the voice, the shape of the character and the boundaries, is it almost written in the DNA of the piece? How long it's going to be then? Is it something that you once you kind of get started, get underway properly, it's inevitable how long it's going to be? Or do you quite often have differing editing process once you've got to the end of the first draft, and then you find, oh, this one's a bit longer, but 2 months later you've edited it down and it's the same length as previously?
Yeah, I think your first point, its DNA is there and does dictate somehow the length. Occasionally I've found But when I'd finished, there was stuff I could scrap.
But not extensive. It's not, you don't really have an editing process where.
Not extensive, and rarely the opposite. Mm. Oh, I need to add, because I probably then wouldn't be able to. So at times I felt, as I did indeed with Hotel Andromeda, I don't think it's quite worked, but I felt it's worked as well as I can make it work, and I still think it's.
And does the same apply, sort of thinking of the ending of the book? Does, once you have the shape and the boundaries, does the end sort of loom up in the far distance, or do you have to get some way through the novel and you sort of realize, oh, it's, I've got another few pages left, and then it's going to end, or this is the last sentence that took me by surprise. I mean, does it vary?
No, the long sentence won't take me by surprise, but it does vary. And there have been quite a few, the majority, I think, where I've had the sense, as I say, there's a particular rhythm and I'm working towards that. And that rhythm is usually the rhythm which has to do with closure, with some kind of ending. But occasionally, no. I've gone in feeling sort of rather more exploratory. And at a certain point, halfway or something, felt, yes, okay, I'm more than halfway.
You have a sense of... And would that translate typically into a sense of time in the real world? They've said, oh, I've probably got another 3 weeks, or I've got another 2 months and I'll be finished. Or is that kind of disconnected? Your writing time is the same in hours per day, but in terms of how far away you are from the end, it could vary? Or do you have quite a rhythm in terms of your writing that, you know, okay, I start it, 4 months later, I'll be finished one way or the other?
Absolutely not. And sometimes, I mean, with one or two books, well, with more than one or two books, they've been started, put away in drawers, and then maybe prodded me. I felt, no, I need to go back to it. And if I finish something, I go back, start again. But then it still doesn't work. And that's gone on for years. And then take it out and finally it does work. Or finally I say, well, no, it's never going to. So it's all, you know, it's very instinctive, and it is sort of hit and miss. But on the length thing, it could be, I've often thought that maybe I wrote very short books because I felt, you know, I had a summer vacation really with, you know, 2-3 months free to write, and I need to get the thing written. But I don't think it's quite that. It is that I like to write. I discovered early on that it was good to just go straight in. If it could keep going, just keep going, not reread. And that could mean that the whole thing was done in 10, 15, 20 days. But maybe there'd been lots of false starts. And then still, you know, a year or so of, you know, further rewriting.
Mm-hmm. What's the sort of editing process then? If you tend to work all the way through in a sort of concerted blast over a few months, do you then... Are there bits that you leave knowing they need substantial work to go back to, or can you not go on with it until you've solved the problems that you've made for yourself?
You know, I've always loved and felt absolutely unable to follow someone like Thomas Mann, who would spend, you know, 6 months on a chapter, and then that chapter was done and put away, and he knew it was there. So it didn't matter if you had 10 years, it was building up slowly. I never know till it's finished if the whole thing isn't going to collapse and I just have to, you know, to give it up. So it's been time that in a way has got lost or wasted. So I tend to write it fast and then copy and let again the copying move me in directions perhaps I wasn't expecting or hadn't been there in that first draft, and it follows that. So I don't even reread that first draft, because I know if I reread it at that point, I might be tempted just to burn it or to to just put in the waste paper basket. So I tend to write and rewrite and rewrite. And sometimes I come upon sentences where I know that the next sentence has to go like this and like that. And I think, this time I'm going to get it right. And then I read it and I've got that sentence in that same way the first time. And I never know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, if it means that I'm, you know, consistent and this is really what I was up to, or whether I'm compulsive and limited and, you know, can only do this sort of thing.
So you're doing it in the sort of second draft. That's entirely from kind of memory of what you did in the first draft?
No, not memory. No, I have the typescript.
Okay, so you're writing it out again.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah.
I tend to start, that's the lovely bit. The first bit is horrible. And then if I've got something, I can then start at the top and feel, yes, you know, there's something a little bit more solid under my feet. And I can then sort of start to build on that and then do a number of drafts.
On a technical point, how do you, the first draft, do you write that, is it on a computer or longhand, or how does that get onto paper, so to speak?
Right at the start, when I was still a graduate student, I realized that I was writing stories for magazines and things. I just, doing it by handwriting, my handwriting was getting smaller and smaller. I was getting so self-conscious, I wasn't getting past the first paragraph and so on. So I went out and bought a secondhand typewriter and learned to some extent how to touch type. And because I felt I needed something that was a bit distant from me, that would have a rhythm that wasn't entirely my hand, my body, the opposite of what most people say they want from their writing, which is tactile, et cetera, et cetera. I wanted it out there and I wanted the thing to be almost impersonal, so that when it appeared on the page, I felt, no, that's fine. It hasn't got the taint, as it were, of my personal, you know, hand on it. It's sort of taking off on its own. And I kept on with a typewriter even after computers were there, because I was terrified, you know, like with a tennis racket or cricket ball, whatever that one has used for a long time, one feels one knows every little bit of it, and to pick up a new one is almost unthinkable.
So you have the same physical typewriter? And,
well, I then unfortunately started to get quite bad arthritis quite early on in my late 40s, early 50s, and I'd written that critical book about the Bible, which was quite a lot of typing out and work, and I went to see the doctor and I said, I'm really worried. My fingers are, you know, my life, and my hands are my life. I depend on it. But, you know, I'm really developing this rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis. And I'm very worried. And he said, well, don't you think that, you know, these days there are things called computers where the touch is a great deal lighter? And you might find it a good idea to, anyway, as one thing, to move on to that from the time. And it was a big, big wrench. But at first I longed for the ping at the end of the line of the old typewriter. And somebody said, oh, you can install it on your computer. It's not the same because it's mechanical, you know. So I felt, no, what I liked was simply its call to arms, you know, end of line, whoomp. Back to the first. All that was gone. But then, you know, these things are all a matter of habit, like changing car or whatever. And after a while, I began not to think about it. But I'd still go on. I'd love to write by hand. And I remember when I got to know Saul Bellow a little bit, when he was down at Monk's house for a few months, the university had invited him to stay in the old Virginia Woolf house. And he said, you should be able to write anywhere on anything, you know, write in a plane or a piece of paper, you know, it's ridiculous all this having to do it on a typewriter. And I agreed with him, but I can't do it again. I can do it to sort of think out things, ideas, or occasionally the odd sentence. but not really for a sustained bit.
And so I guess that the rewriting process, you print out what you've written on the computer and then have that beside you and then retype it again.
And print it out again.
And do you read again. Do you read the draft at all? Like out loud as part of the editing, or it's...
No, I hate that. And when I have to read the proofs, it's the biggest nightmare of all. But I think, you know, people say, oh, the advantage of computers is you don't have to start again at the top of the page. That's exactly what I love. I love starting again at the top of the page, having it there already, and then I can move away from it as the rhythm starts to take over. And again, almost a sort of physical thing. I have to get into it. That's why rereading, I often feel one comes to the wrong decisions. Obviously it has the opposite thing as well, that if you're too close into it, at some point you do need to stand back or have a very trusty reader who'll say, hey, you know, this needs a bit of this or a bit of that. That is the way that I tend to work. I find if I'm rereading, even with an essay, a critical thing, or a review even, I'd much rather really just start again at the top and rewrite it or copy it out. Find by the end, I've more or less copied it out exactly as it was. That's fine. Because if I read it, I'm standing back too far from it and I haven't really got the everything in my head as to why decisions have to be made in one direction or another. Mm-hmm.
We've been speaking to you for nearly an hour now, so thank you for joining us in the time. I just wanted to ask if you're working on anything at the moment or if you've got anything coming out soon.
I don't have anything coming out soon, but not fiction, alas, but I thought during this lockdown, and my partner, who's usually in London, and we both need our sort of space, was going to come and share it with me. I didn't want to drive her up the wall by trying to get into something really that was going to be quite hard for me. So I thought, I need a project that's going to be relatively easy and pleasant and will take up the mornings, and then, you know, we can do something together in the afternoon. And so I had this idea of a 100-day diary. With an alphabetically induced set of memories or thoughts, which could be about a book or it could be about something in the past, and so on. And I more or less stuck to that, and do one a day. So it's shortish, you know, I don't know, anything from 1,000 to 2,500 words. And I stuck to that for 100 days. I thought I'd do 100 days and go through the alphabet. Of course, it's a very weak constraint. I get to choose what within the A's and the B's are going to be the things. But it still did prod me into doing certain things. I mean, I remembered, which I wouldn't have thought of, with the A's, there's a little town just outside Alexandria, Agami, or a little holiday resort, which had been quite interesting in my past. So suddenly that was there. And, you know, I wouldn't really have thought of writing about Zazie dans le métro, but there aren't many Z's. And then I suddenly thought, yes, actually, I would quite like. The other constraint was not to write about things I'd written about before. So Ivy Compton-Bennett goes in, but not, you know, Blanchot or whatever.
And did it have to be in alphabetical order? Like you started A on day one and B.
Yeah. And I made a quick sketch of the things I'd like, and then every afternoon after we'd been for a walk and so on over tea or something, I'd look at that and maybe add a few things or take a few things away. And in the end, it came to about 86. I'm just in the process of revising it, about 86 of these to 100 days. And then by the end of the 100 days, they were more or less saying, well, you know, lockdown's over, et cetera, et cetera. So whether that's any good or there for me, it certainly was a good thing. I felt
it sounds a good project during these strange times.
It was not too demanding, but it was just sat me down every day. And I felt, do it during the day. Okay, just do it this today. And sometimes I had no idea. And some things which looked promising as subjects tended to fall flat. And others which I thought, well, yeah, again, there's not many Zs or whatever, suddenly took off. So it was quite fun.
Thank you to Gabriel for joining us, and thank you for listening. That was episode 33. If you'd like to find more episodes from our back catalogue, you can visit us at unsignedmethods.co.uk or find us on Twitter at unsignedmethods.
Yeah, you can find out about me and my writing at Jamie Batchen on Twitter, at Jamie_Batchen on Instagram, or my website is jamiebatchen.com.
And you can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com or on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
Gabriel does actually have a website, and we will put that in the episode notes below. So you'll find out more about him there.